there's so much going on with PSP right now because people are dropping dead, levels are high all up and down the coast from British Columbia all along the coast.
Unexplained high levels of paralytic shellfish poisoning in the Aleutians. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 5th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, finding a solution to low king salmon runs in the Yukon.
If you think it's a disaster right now, you just wait for another 10, 15, 20 years and there is not going to be nothing left in this river.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance has a simple request. If you smoke, take it outside. Smoking hurts more than just you. Secondhand smoke increases the risk of coronary heart disease and kills nearly 50,000 non-smoking Americans every year. Smoking around your kids causes chronic and life-threatening diseases and is linked to sudden infant death syndrome. If you choose to smoke, make a choice that protects others who don't. Take it outside. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Alaska senators are split on the next United States Supreme Court justice. Elena Kagan won confirmation today by the Senate on a vote of 63-37. Senator Mark Begich joined with all but one of his Democratic colleagues in supporting her. Five Republicans crossed over to vote for her, but Senator Lisa Murkowski voted no. Murkowski says her greatest concern is with Kagan's lack of a record on gun rights issues.
I think one of the responses and just kind of the background that she had given that struck me most was how little she conveyed in terms of understanding and a historical appreciation of the Second Amendment.
But Senator Begich disagrees. He says Kagan made it clear she respects the right to bear arms.
I had a great conversation with her about Second Amendment rights, that even though it's interesting, if you live to the Senate, people heard different things. But I felt very comfortable with that she recognizes the court cases that have come forth, that it was clear to her that it's settled law, which to me was something I wanted to hear her say, that it wasn't a law that still is in question, meaning that people can enjoy their right to bear arms, their individual right. So I felt comfortable there.
Murkowski says she's glad to see a fourth ever woman reach the bench, but she's critical that Kagan will join five other sitting justices from the northeastern states.
Coming from that Washington-Boston corridor, going to one of three law schools of choice, that's not so important, although it does concern me that you don't have any real appreciation of what it means to be in a rural part of the country. She was somewhat flip when she suggested, well, does Chicago count when it comes to rural? No, it really does not count.
Kagan grew up in New York City and attended Princeton, Oxford, and Harvard Law School. Now that the Senate has confirmed her, she will take the bench for the Supreme Court's next term. In southwest Alaska, clams and mussels are testing positive for the paralytic shellfish poisoning toxin and at unusually high levels. The news is creating anxiety in the region, especially given events earlier in the summer when two people in southeast Alaska died of PSP and three other cases were reported. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has more.
Summertime in the Aleutian Islands means enjoying the subsistence harvest and digging into things like halibut, salmon, and king crab, but not clams or mussels. A project undertaken by the Aleutians Pribilof Islands Association has revealed a dangerous level of toxins that could lead to paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP, in shellfish across the region. The group doing this work is called the Response to Paralytic Shellfish Poisoning in Aleut Communities Project, and they're funded by the Environmental Protection Agency and managed by APIA. They found fatal levels of PSP toxins in shellfish from Sandpoint to Accutan to Unalaska. The results for Accutan were released just yesterday, and they show that mussels are testing at almost five times the FDA level for PSP toxicity. What's especially strange is that the island doesn't seem to have a history of PSP problems. Bruce Wright is a senior scientist with APIA, and he says that he hasn't seen levels this high here before.
It seems to be one of those places that seems to be relatively PSP-free. And And it looks like our data up until this last month has shown that to be the case. And then, boom, you can see that muscles shot up really high. Their levels were around 390. And the FDA limit, again, is 80.
Unalaska shellfish also experienced a midsummer jump. In May, it was testing at 30 micrograms per 100 grams, well below the toxin limit of 80. In the warmer month of July, that level jumped to 331. Sandpoint shellfish is even more toxic. The samples tested there came in at 926. That's over 11 times the toxicity cutoff, and much higher than its recorded rates have ever been. PSP can cause death by paralyzing internal organs and making it difficult to breathe. Wright says more and more cases seem to be popping up across the state.
Whenever I gave a presentation in a community, everybody in the audience would say either I've had those symptoms or somebody they knew has had those symptoms in the last few years. And the symptoms are, these are PSP symptoms. It's tingling of your fingers or lips, numbness of your lips, nausea, headaches, dizziness, slurred speech. These are all PSP symptoms.
Wright has studied PSP in the region since 1978, but says that monitoring has only been intermittent because of lack of resources. APIA last tested on Alaska shellfish in 2006, and even then summer levels were high. Wright says that there's a lot of interest in his work from subsistence harvesters, but that he can't exactly provide answers to all of their questions yet.
There's so much going on with PSP right now because people are dropping dead. Levels are high all up and down the coast from British Columbia, all along the coast. And so there's a million questions out there, and we have no funding or support to answer those questions. We can't predict what's going to happen with PSP levels. We don't know if it's a climate change issue or if it's something else.
In Unalaska, word about the PSP toxin levels has spread through the Kowalungan tribe and the city's clinic. The Department of Environmental Conservation has also been distributing literature on PSP. There's been an effort to reach out to seasonal workers and non-native speakers who might not be familiar with the risk of eating shellfish. Becky Sheffield is an environmental health officer at the DEC, and she says that the department has provided information in 7 different languages to the fish processing plants.
It's something I believe most of the processors go over in their orientation, too, that, you know, it's not good to consume the mussels and shellfish and things like that from the area. You know, the water may look clean, but it's an organism we can't see, so it's not good to do it.
The city of Accutane has been doing similar outreach. Mayor Joseph Bereskin says that while subsistence harvesting still happens in Accutane, it has declined in popularity, and this is probably a good thing. No cases have been reported there yet, and he's hoping that none will.
Knock on wood, yes.
There also haven't been any reports of PSP cases in Sandpoint or Unalaska. In June, 5 cases of PSP were reported in the state, resulting in 2 deaths. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, finding spruce roots for basket weaving in Southeast.
It always is exciting to be in the woods. It's like Easter egg hunting when you're a child.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Some Yukon River residents have grave concerns about the river's Chinook salmon stocks. As another in a string of below-average runs nears its end, too few kings have made it across the border to meet fishing demand. Environmental factors like climate change as well as at-sea bycatch have been pointed to as possible factors in the decline of Yukon king stocks over the last decade. But as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, fishermen and fishery managers also bear responsibility.
Worries about the survival of Yukon Chinook were voiced this week during a Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association teleconference. Carl Sidney with the Council of First Nations in Teslin, Yukon, said fishermen may not have any kings to fight over in the future.
If you think it's a disaster right now, you just wait for another 10, 15, 20 years and there is not going to be nothing left in this river. I don't think that we're fighting over fish. up here in Teslin and I think in the Yukon, we're fighting for the fish.
The Yukon Council of First Nations has been shipping in salmon from other areas to help compensate for the lack of kings in the upper Yukon. The Alaska Board of Fish has approved a net mesh size reduction that takes effect next year, aimed at getting additional bigger, more productive kings upstream. But Sydney questioned whether that'll be enough to save the salmon.
They've moved the mesh size down to 7.5-inch mesh. All that means to me is you're taking the next generations of fish. The 4-, 5-, 6-year-olds will be gone, and then we just keep working at it until there's nothing left. I totally think people better start thinking about stopping fishing, and if your government could help you in some other ways to subsistence, somehow or another with money or getting fish from somewhere else, you better start looking into it, because there's not going to be much fishery left in the future.
Sydney wasn't alone in voicing concerns about Yukon King survival. Farther downstream at Galena, Village Second Chief Fred Huntington Sr. agreed that all age classes of Chinook need to be conserved.
When I talked with my old man, Sidney Huntington, he's 95 years old, he said the only way you could save the kings is to cut it off for 12 to 20 years to build those cycles back up to where all those cycles will be able to have full and strong returns. Until then, we're going to be depleting the salmon.
Yukon River salmon managers are trying to satisfy fishermen, subsistence, commercial, and sport, not all of whom take the long view. During a similar week Chinook run last year, managers eliminated a subsistence fishing period on the Alaska side to get more kings into Canada and ended up exceeding Canadian escapement and fishing goals. Voluntary conservation has been the tactic this summer. It's unknown how the new net mesh reduction will affect the number of kings that make it upstream. And Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologist Steve Hayes said there may also have to be fishing restrictions.
I think at this point it's pretty safe to say we're going to probably be looking at having to do something similar to what we did in 2009, which was, you know, pulling a period. But that's something we will work out this winter.
Hayes told teleconference participants managers are open to suggestions on how to handle the fishery. With an estimated 3/4 of the run through, the sonar counter near the Alaska-Canada border has tallied 30,000 kings. The escapement goal is 42,500 fish. The count near the mouth of the Yukon was 114,000 kings, a number also off last year and well below the historic mean. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
GCI customers in rural Alaska can expect some telephone and internet outages next week thanks to a wayward satellite. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
A satellite that was stationed about 22,000 miles above the equator lost its propulsion system back in April. That satellite, which is called Galaxy 15, is drifting to the east across the equator and is crossing the path of other satellites. GCI spokesman David Morris says that next week the satellite is expected to get very close to a communication satellite run by GCI called Galaxy 18. That satellite is the primary telecommunication satellite for rural Alaska.
Unfortunately, the engineers on the ground, the technicians, were not able to turn the satellite off before it started that drift. So essentially, it's a live satellite drifting through space with no propulsion, and when it comes in contact close proximity to other satellites, it duplicates the signal that is being sent back and forth, and effectively it makes the communication impossible to discern. So in August, between August 11th and the 14th, that satellite will be close to Galaxy 18, which is what GCI uses for its rural telecommunications. And there will be outages of approximately 29 hours over the course of 4 days.
Galaxy 15 is being called a zombie satellite, and it's operated by Intelsat Communications, which is the world's largest provider of fixed satellite services. The satellite stopped responding to controllers on the ground on the 5th of April. It was launched into space in October of 2005, and it's believed that it was damaged by a massive solar storm in early April. The satellite is still receiving and broadcasting, but it's believed that eventually the satellite will lose its lock on the Earth and the solar panels will no longer be pointed towards the sun. Once that happens, the satellite's batteries will eventually die. The outages are expected to happen from August the 11th through the 14th, and there will likely be 2 outages a day that could last from 1.5 hours to 5.5 hours each. Morris notes that calls from the road system, southeast Alaska, or other areas outside of Alaska to rural Alaska will not be affected.
If you're calling from or calling to rural Alaska off the road system, chances are you're using a satellite. And what we're able to do simply because of the location is we'll automatically route those calls that go from the road system to rural Alaska. We'll be able to automatically route those through another satellite. Now, the problem with doing it in reverse is that for rural Alaska, we have sites all over rural Alaska. And if we were to redirect all the dishes to that to another satellite for this outage, it would actually cause, when we started doing the math, it would cause more of an outage than what these outages will ensue.
In a statement, GCI noted that it's working to make sure that Alaska's major medical facilities stay on the air during the predicted outages. This will happen by either redirecting their traffic to another satellite or by installing additional facilities. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Calista, the regional native corporation for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, announced the purchase of two new companies. The corporation says they will bring more money and jobs to their shareholders. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning-Barnes has more.
Calista has purchased two Alaska-based companies, Bryce Incorporated and Yukon Equipment Incorporated.
These two companies are already profitable.
Calista President Matthew Nikolai.
We're taking over them this month, and that means August, September, October, November, December. That's, 5-6 months? That new revenue stream will be definite advantage to Calista.
Both Bryce and Yukon Equipment are decades-old Alaska companies that deal in construction. Bryce Incorporated and its family of companies has been around for 40 years and focuses on construction-type projects in rural Alaska, projects dealing with civil construction like ice roads, excavations, site preparation, soil compacting, and erosion control. The other company acquired by Calista, Yukon Equipment, was founded in 1945, and it's the oldest Alaska-owned heavy equipment dealer in the state. The company deals in Case brand construction equipment.
The family there has worked on developing equipment or selling equipment and leasing equipment for residential, commercial, roads, bridges, and basically government construction.
Nikolai says the company acquisitions will not only make more profit for Calista shareholders, but there will be more jobs for them as well.
Basically focus on profits and also local hire programs that benefit our people.
Nikolai says buying Yukon equipment adds to the construction capacity of Bryce and Calista's existing construction subsidiary, Tunista Construction. Calista is the for-profit regional native corporation for the YK Delta. The corporation represents over 13,000 shareholders in 56 villages. With the new acquisitions, Calista now owns 8 Alaska-based businesses. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Earlier this week, Cook Inlet Housing Authority celebrated the opening of Eklutna Estates, a 59-unit senior housing project in northeast Anchorage. During the dedication, the authority pointed to unique features and the considerable need prompting the project. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
During a rare Anchorage moment of sunny skies, more than 200 people gathered outside the two wings of the brand-new four-story Eklutna Estates. They included Cook Inlet Housing Authority staff, contractors, agency people, members of the financial community, elected officials, and seniors. Some of the elders' interest in the new building went beyond the ceremony.
In the last few weeks, we accepted 153 applications for 59 units.
Carol Kaur is president and CEO of Cook Inlet Housing Authority. Data from the Alaska Commission on Aging's Senior Snapshot shows that for the second year in a row, Alaska has the fastest growing senior population in the country at almost 50%. That finding covers individuals 65 years of age and older and is calculated during the past 10 years. Anchorage's senior population increased nearly 40% between 2001 and 2008. The Alaska Division of Public Assistance reports that nearly 20% in Anchorage receive state senior benefits. Jeff Judd, the authority's vice president of real estate, says most units have a sliding rate based on income.
We have 59 total units, 51 of which are income restricted. 8 units are unrestricted by income, or what we generally refer to as market rate units.
In his grand opening celebration remarks, Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan praised the facility's construction standards.
This is really a leading-edge technology building in terms of environmental construction and awareness. Really shows that we're at the forefront of doing some great things in Anchorage.
Aklutna Estates exceeds the top 5-star rating of the State of Alaska Building Energy Efficiency Standards. It has Energy Star certified appliances, in-floor radiant heat, and exterior glazing and insulated windows. Among the amenities, there are several common spaces, including a rooftop terrace garden adjacent to a community meeting and kitchen area. The total development cost was nearly $24 million. Aklutna Estates will also be the first of Cook Inlet Housing Authority's many properties to put a new quality of life rule into effect. No smoking is allowed within the building. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Pictures of the new Aklutna Estates are at our website, aprn.org. Kruzoff Island is 168 square miles of land popping out of the Pacific Ocean just west of Sitka. It holds a volcano, a trail system, a series of beaches, meadowlands, and forest. During World War II, it was a strategic location for U.S. forces. It's also where KCAW's Lily Mahalik found an 80-year-old Haida weaver hot on the trail of young spruce roots for her baskets.
We'll follow this one. This looks like a good one.
That's the sound of master basket weaver Dolores Churchill digging through the forest for spruce roots. She's on Kruzoff Island as part of a University of Alaska Southeast course that teaches the ancient art. Churchill grew up on the Queen Charlotte Islands and says for her ancestors, basket weaving was a part of everyday life.
Everybody wove, and everybody wove their own baskets. And some of them, they carried water. Some of them, they used as a drinking glass. Some of them were for harvesting clams. Some of them were for harvesting berries. There were, when we collected bird eggs, we had a little basket that we put our bird eggs in. But we also put moss between the bird eggs.
But as time went on, the tradition lost its footing. Even Churchill didn't learn to weave until she was 40, when her mother, Selena Petrovich, also an acclaimed weaver, finally agreed to teach her.
And then I got so addicted to weaving. I'd be weaving even in the middle of the night. I loved it. Even though my husband was, really thought my baskets were beautiful, my mother said, well, if you're going to learn from me, you can't sell those ugly baskets. So she actually burned them. She would burn them for like 5 years, maybe 4 or 5 years.
Nowadays, Churchill is done burning her baskets and is busy keeping the age-old tradition alive. Standing on the beach near Fred's Creek, Churchill explains to a group of students the sacred tradition of gathering roots.
Native people really think of the trees as having their spirit, so we really honor the trees. And when we gather, we always say, We're going to gather from your trees. We're going to gather the roots. But we also want you to continue to grow so that our grandchildren and great-grandchildren will be able to come back here and harvest again.
After giving thanks, the class marches into the coastal forest. There, Churchill scans the mossy floor, dodging tree limbs and climbing over logs. The 80-year-old Churchill kneels to all fours, looking for a place where roots are likely to be close to the surface. There, she digs in and pulls one out, following it back to a spruce tree.
It always is exciting to be in the woods. It's like Easter egg hunting when you're a child.
Churchill students come from all over the United States and are equally excited to be on the hunt.
We want to find them the right diameter.
There's a baby. Yeah. There's a baby, so maybe we'll... I'm Marge Stewart. I have never searched for these roots before. I've been weaving cedar bark baskets for about 10 years, but I've never worked with spruce root before. So this is exciting.
One right here.
Yes, we're looking good.
Other students are newer to the craft with different agendas.
My wife said it'd keep me busy. 53 and retired, so she said I needed to stay busy. I said, okay, I'll do it.
This week-long course will take them through each step of basket weaving, from collecting the roots to cooking them over a hot fire, and then skinning their bark and splitting them into weavable pieces. After each student collects their roots, the group walks back to the beach to make a roaring fire. Their roots, twisted into figure eights, are placed on the end of green branches and roasted. Once they charcoal and hiss, Dolores pulls one out and strips its bark by running it through a Y-shaped stick.
Okay, somebody give me... You have to do it real fast, so give me one of those... Okay. I'm not entertaining you. Get to work.
As she works, red, bubbling bark shoots off the root, leaving it a smooth, opalescent cream. Next, she splits each root, holding one end between her teeth and peeling back thin strips with her fingers and a small knife.
And I'm sorry, I'm making it look easy. It's not going to be that easy.
She always makes it look easy.
Easy or not, Churchill says the tradition almost died with her generation, but it's classes like these and wild places to forage, like Kruzoff Island, that give her hope the tradition will continue. Reporting from Fred's Creek on Kruzoff Island, this is Lily Mahalik.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Lily Mahalik in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network. APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.